Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. What keeps towns vibrant? Usually is efforts by the town and local community groups to make sure the town is well-maintained and there are wonderful opportunities to engage in town-wide events. It's about having services that keep the residents active, healthy, and educated. Today, we're going to learn about how a group in Waterbury is going about making sure it's ticking those boxes and making it a place those living there have great pride in. Joining me now are a couple of members of Waterbury Arts, a small group of arts enthusiasts. Laura Perrette is a graphic designer and a community volunteer. Laura, thanks for being on the program this morning.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
You're welcome. And Whitney Aldrich is the owner of Axel's Gallery right here on Stowe Street in Waterbury, and she is spearheading a project we're going to discuss this morning. It's called the Phoenix Rising Project. Whitney, thank you for being here as well.
Oh, thanks, Rick. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests about what they've got planned for Waterbury, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Laura, what is Waterbury Arts?
So it's a small group of individuals that wanted to see more public art in our downtown specifically, but we also love to branch out to other parts of Waterbury. And I think we only organized about a year and a half ago. Is that right, Whitney?
Yeah, that's about right.
All right. Well, congratulations. Happy anniversary. And Laura, why did the group get together?
We all had a shared want for more public art in our, specifically in our downtown. We also understand the benefits that public art can be for the community as well as for tourism. And, we felt like it was time to take that first step and start creating some more public art in our downtown.
Whitney, who are the members of Waterbury Arts?
Right now, it is Laura and I, Sarah Lee Trott, Ann Imhoff, Jack Carter, and Nate and Tyler Keith.
So a decent-sized group. I had it a little smaller. What is the group's mission, Whitney?
We're trying to encourage the ongoing development of temporary and public art in Waterbury.
And Laura, does Waterbury have a lot of public art currently?
In my opinion, I would go with no. but things are on the move. I mean, a nice first example was the Waterbury Special, the train sculpture that went up on the train bridge right by the roundabout.
Yep.
You know, everybody just loves that piece. It was really well done by Revitalizing Waterbury as well as the Rotary. And, I think it was a good, stepping stone for us to try and get, some more art into the downtown.
I have to admit, that piece on the rail bridge, it's wonderful, and I never tire seeing it when I drive into town. How did that come about, Laura?
You know, that'd be a better question for Whitney, because
okay.
She sat on that committee.
Great. Whitney?
Boy, that was so long ago. It feels like it was a big project that Barb Farr and Karen Nevin really took the lead on developing. But again, it was this sense of wanting to celebrate history through art in our town. And while that one is more of a, representative piece where it's directly representing specific activities or architecture within the town and celebrating it in a contemporary way, the Phoenix Rising is more of an abstract version of celebrating our town's history and overcoming challenges and not in such worth. But that Waterbury Special Project was certainly a really important piece for people to recognize how important art could be in our town.
Yeah, that really hits it hard. It certainly makes that point, and it is absolutely stunning when you drive in. But you've transitioned beautifully, Whitney, into the Phoenix Rising Project. So tell us what that is.
The Phoenix Rising Art Project is an idea that was born from a lantern in the River of Light Lantern Parade right after the flood in 2011. After Tropical Storm Irene ravaged the town, it was our town's community efforts were celebrated through, well, a lot of ways, but specifically through the River of Light Lantern Parade that M.K. Monley and Maine McKee was organizing or part of the organizing, and they had created this Phoenix lantern that was huge. And it really was the anchor to that year's parade. And that just, that symbol, that imagery just sat with me for years. And I just wanted to somehow continue that momentum or have something that the beauty of, have the beauty of celebration through tribulations like that is just something that I've been eager to bring to the community.
And describe what it is for people, you know, this mural that'll be on the side of your building, actually.
Yeah, well, it's a building that's owned by the Ken Squire Trust, and it's not quite a mural. It is, a mural is more of traditionally a painted surface, and considering that it's a historic building, we've gotten the guidance from the director of state historic buildings, Jamie Duggan in town. He has recommended that if art were to be placed on that wall, it should be done in a way that it would preserve the historic integrity. So that being the case, we have created a piece of art that is actually on an aluminum panel or series of panels that actually has the artwork placed on top of that. And in this sense, it's not actually painted by brush, although it is from an original gouache painting.
And who's
designing
it? So it's
actually more of a, the woman who created the original artwork is a former Waterbury resident. Her name is Jessica Zawicki. She now lives in St. Albans, and she won the design contest that we held in December of 2019. We had pitched a contest of we're looking for this mythical bird to celebrate the rise in community in Waterbury, and we had over a dozen applicants, but hers by far stood out from all of them.
And will she be as well doing the actual painting on the panels, or how will that be done?
The actual painting is being reinterpreted onto the panels in through a vinyl graphic. So we're taking her artwork and scaling it to be two-story high, and then it's going to be applied onto the aluminum panel.
And Laura, so this will be taking place, the unveiling later this year. So tell us about that and other events tied to that.
Sure. So some people may not know this, but this will be the 10th anniversary of Tropical Storm Irene. And thank you to WDV 10 years ago for holding up this state together during that terrible time. So it's August 28th is the actual, August 27, 28th. The storm came in on the 27th into the 28th. So the town of Waterbury and Revitalizing Waterbury are organizing to have some acknowledgement of what the community went through and how resilient we are and how we grew out of that, much like Phoenix rising out of the ashes. as well as there will be a celebration also about Main Street Reconstruction being completed here. And if any of your listeners have driven through Waterbury in the last 2.5 to 3 years, you know, it's been quite a bit of chaos. But we've got this beautiful new Main Street repaved and new sidewalks and period lighting and lots of improvements that historic downtown wait a long time to have done, and our time is due now.
Nice. And we can call it organized chaos, Laura. I've been through a lot worse.
It's right outside your door.
I know it is. And Whitney's as well. And Whitney, getting back to the Phoenix Rising Project, so what's the timeline of a piece like this?
Well, we're hoping to install it the first week of August so we can work on any bugs that might come up before the unveiling, which will be right on the 10th year anniversary of Tropical Storm Irene, August 28th, Saturday. That's what our goal is.
Nice. And what is the size of this painting?
It's going to be approximately 22 feet high and 21 feet wide.
And the colors are absolutely vibrant and wonderful, aren't they?
Yeah. The artist, Jesse Zawicki, did a fabulous job. We have the original artwork, too. And if you get a chance to see the original artwork, it is truly stunning.
Mm. Laura, what other projects does Waterbury Arts hope to undertake?
I'm just going to add a little something to what Whitney said.
Please.
Is that if people want to see the actual artwork, well, they could stop by at Axel's and see it, mm-hmm. Axel's Gallery. But it's also on our website, waterburyarts.com. And there's actually an artist rendering of how it will look on the side of the building, because it is two stories high. It's outstanding.
Yep.
It'll help people visualize some, but... back to your question, which was what other projects are we working on?
That's right, Laura.
Yes, right. So we're looking a little down the road, you know, kind of got to get past this one, but we are looking to have more public art in the downtown or even partnering with Revitalizing Waterbury perhaps because they're working on some public art initiatives as well. And we also have, and you can find a little more about this on our website as well. There's a little Waterbury Minis project that is already in place. People would have to scope it out. They're actually, little mini placed sculptures in different store edges and around town.
Mm.
It's almost You'd almost have to be like a scavenger hunt to source them out. So looking to expand that as well.
That's great. And I know, Laura, you're looking for input and feedback from the community on future projects. So how does the community take part in what Waterbury Arts is looking forward to in the future?
They could go to the website. We have a contact page there. So it's waterburyarts.com. Arts with an S at the end. Love feedback. You know, the chances of running into Whitney or Jack Carter or myself in town, that's a good way to have communication as well.
Mm-hmm. And Whitney, are there, I know, you've got the Phoenix Rising Project now going. Are there other basic ideas that the group has in mind that they'd like to see throughout the town?
Yeah, you know, we've done an exercise last year of identifying some places within the downtown core and beyond where we could envision public sculpture, actually. And we started initial conversations with the town and members within RW to start that momentum. And also with artists, we had plenty of artists who were willing to loan pieces of art that they already had in inventory around our town. So that's one project that we're hoping to get back to. Considering the 10-year anniversary for the Phoenix Rising project, we felt like we needed to place that as a higher priority, but this will certainly not be the only project that this group is involved in. We're very dedicated to seeing more accessible art in town, so seeing them outside, whether they're in private spaces that are viewable from public areas or directly in public spaces, we are definitely dedicated to getting more of it in our town.
And Laura Whitney mentioned the town of Waterbury, revitalizing Waterbury. So what involvement and how will you work, Waterbury Arts, work with those groups to kind of maximize art in the town?
Well, revitalizing Waterbury is always a great source as a nonprofit for fundraising and grant writing, things like that. So we are in constant communication with them. So that should make life a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm. Whitney, why does public art matter to a town?
I think public art brings a wealth of opportunities to celebrate our history, our culture, the people who live here, the views that we hold as a community. It's something that people want to be around. It green brings us vibrancy. People are more apt to engage with the community through art. Businesses want to be located in places that have a vibrant art scene. People want to visit places that have an art scene. So I think all around the having public art just contributes to the creative economy within a town.
Laura, are there public benefits to public art in a town?
There certainly are in terms of tourism.
Mm-hmm.
There's studies out there that talk about communities that have, whether it's a growing group of artists and galleries or it's public art, people want to visit because tourists have interests of all types. It's not just our craft beer culture and our farm to table. You know, we've got recreation and all those other wonderful things, and adding public art of all types to this mix just makes Waterbury more of a destination.
And, Laura, you mentioned earlier you were talking about the Main Street Reconstruction Project in Waterbury. So when that is complete, how will this downtown look? Give us a picture of what the completed project is.
Oh, it's going to look outstanding. It'll be, I don't know, I've lived here for 30 years. It'll be the first time that the sidewalks are all on the same playing field, you know, no tripping hazards. The Main Street and Stowe Street will be beautifully paved and marked. We've got period lighting going up. There'll be flower baskets hanging off of them. There's a banner project. Banners will be hanging off of those period lights. There's going to be recycle bins and garbage cans that all have the same look. Like, everything's going to sink finally.
Mm-hmm. Why has this been an important undertaking for the town of Waterbury?
The Main Street reconstruction?
Yes.
Yeah. I think the town's been working on this project. You know, it's got mostly federal funding, some state, and then a little bit of town funding. And they've been working on this one for at least 30 years, you know. Plus, it was really all the infrastructure. All the sewer lines need to be replaced. All
right.
The power lines are going to be buried eventually. So all that conduit stuff and the telephone poles and cable poles and all that stuff is all going to go away. It's going to have a very clean look, which will really enhance the look of public art.
Yep. And Whitney, as a business owner in the heart of Waterbury, you know, how do you see these undertakings helping the business community?
I think it's just another reason that's going to drive people to want to live, play, and into work here. I'm really excited, even though, you know, we're, you know, in the middle of the third year of construction, which is, it's hard as a business to function during periods when it's a challenge to, for people to get to your business. But I can't be more excited for it to be completed.
Whitney, I know you've lived in, I think, Cincinnati. Are there other cities or towns, either in Vermont or elsewhere, where you see a vibrant public art program that, that Waterbury could emulate?
Boy, that's a good question. I feel like wherever I travel, understanding what art, what venues there are to see art is really important for when I book my travel. I feel like I've been in a lot of places, not recently, of course, because of our travel restrictions, but I remember one of my favorite places that I visited was in Texas. It's called Marfa, Texas. Donald Judd has a big presence there, and he was a minimalist artist, I want to say back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And it was, it's an entire town that has embraced the arts, and you can't walk around a corner in that town without experiencing something you've never seen before. And it's the engagement piece where it's not just something to be seen. It's really an experience that art has brought to that town. So I'd probably say that was, that's been my most favorite visit. And not that we're trying to emulate that in Waterbury, but just a little piece of having that experiencing art and what art can bring to a town and bring to your day and your viewpoint. And it could be a really wonderful opportunity for our town.
Whitney Aldrich is the owner of Axel's Gallery in Waterbury, and she's spearheading the Phoenix Rising Project. Laura Perrette is a graphic designer and a community volunteer. They are both members of Waterbury Arts. It was great speaking with both of you this morning. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you, Rick. We appreciate the opportunity.
We're still fundraising for this effort. Visit waterburyarts.com, and if you can support us, we'd really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much, Laura. All right, let's take a break for a CBS News update. When we return, we're going to hear about the elephant's new shoe. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Shelburne's Laurel Neamey has camped in the Kalahari, investigated walrus carcasses on Alaska's Bering Sea beaches, and explored the Amazon jungle with the Brazilian Federal Police. It's all in pursuit of knowledge and a better story. Laurel is a journalist who writes about wildlife crime, forensics, and animal intelligence. She is also the author of four books for readers of all ages. Her most recent children's book, The Elephant's New Shoe, is the story of Chook, one of the first animals ever to be fitted with a prosthetic. And Laurel Neamey joins us now to share the tale of Chook and other animals that she's met through her career. Laurel, it is so great to talk to you again. Welcome.
Oh, so great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Listeners, if you've got a question for Laurel Neamey about her latest book or any other of her work, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Laurel, you really have an interesting writing niche. Tell us what that involves.
Well, I write about wildlife across a lot of different sort of categories. So one is I write for Monga Bay, and which is a top environmental news website, as well as National Geographic. But I also write books both for adults. I have animal investigators about wildlife forensics, and then, as you mentioned, some kids' books. And so the common thread through all of that is related to wildlife, wildlife science, and sort of cool things that wildlife and people do to help them.
Have these subjects always been of interest for you, or were you a journalist who somehow found your way into this realm?
No, I've always been interested in animals, and ever since I was a little girl, you know, I was always just very interested in that. I think I wanted to be Jane Goodall growing up, or maybe, you know, James Herriot. I read the All Creatures Great and Small book, Dr. Doolittle. I wanted to talk to the animals. And so in some ways, it's sort of circling back, full circle, getting back into wildlife. And it's, I think the more you learn about them, about different animals, the more they interest me, and it almost seems like a never-ending subject because there's so much to learn and just so much to appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Chook, whose story you tell in The Elephant's New Shoe. What happened to this elephant?
So Chook's a baby elephant that was found in Cambodia, in a forest in Cambodia, and he had an injured leg that had been caught in a poacher's snare. Now, elephants are often hunted for their ivory, and they're also in Cambodia and in many parts of Southeast Asia, they're losing a lot of habitat to development as well. And so Chook had his leg probably caught in a wire snare, and the leg was too injured to be saved. And so when he was found, he was just a month old maybe, and a rescuer from Wildlife Alliance named Nick Marks was called out to help him. And any elephant, even if it's a baby elephant, they're still, 250 pounds, and they can still really hurt a person. So it took a little while for Nick to acclimate the elephant to him, to calm the elephant, to, let him know that he was trying to help. Mm-hmm. And then they brought him back to the rescue center in Phnom Penh, outside Phnom Penh, and was able to help him. And they cleaned up the wound, but he was missing his foot. So he needed to have something to help him walk, because an elephant, his whole skeleton would be deformed if he grew up that way, and he wouldn't survive very long on that. And, Nick could see how depressed Chook was, and, he was in a lot of pain. So Nick really set out to try and help him with a prosthetic foot, a prosthetic leg.
So was prosthetics for animals, was it a thing by then, or was this something that had to be developed just for Chook?
Well, they had, it was very new. He was the first in Cambodia to get it. There had been two elephants in Thailand. So it was very new, and there had been two elephants in Thailand who had their legs hurt and blown off with some landmines. And so some doctors there had, in fact, helped with prosthetic legs and developed that, and Nick had reached out to them, but it wasn't possible. They were too busy. It's very difficult and time consuming to make a prosthetic that's form fitting, that involves multiple fittings, that travel. So they had said no, so he had to do it and find someplace else to help. And in Cambodia, they too had a problem with landmines from the war, the Vietnam War,
right?
And so they had a school of prosthetics and orthotics to help the many people who needed, the people who needed prosthetics from missing limbs. And so they agreed to help. And it was good training for people there. And also, elephants are so endangered, rescuing every single one is really important.
Mm. So I understand he's on his fourth prosthetic leg. Is that because of growing out of them, or does he wear them out?
Both. Actually, it's more like his 17th.
Oh, is it really? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So he gets one about every 6 months.
Wow.
Because, just like kids. I mean, like, think of, any toddler or any kid growing up. Sometimes they wear them out, and sometimes they grow out of them too fast. And elephants are very hard on footwear.
I would imagine.
I actually have one here that I used for school visits, one of Chuck's old ones. You know, the bottom is like a tire that you put on your car. And the, you know, just by example, you think of the treads on your car. Well, the one I have, the tread, you can't see any treads. Like, it's already worn down. So it takes generally about 6 months before they, you know, get either too worn or he's growing. And he is still growing. He's now about 14. And so he's still growing and outgrowing his shoes.
So
I should say, it's actually sort of fun because he has daytime shoes and nighttime shoes. So just like we would put on slippers, he puts on sort of a softer, comfy one for night.
I'm going to say with some help, right?
Yes, with some help.
All right. Wow, that's fascinating. Now, you've written for MangaBay.com a story called Life in New Limbs, Creative Thinking, 3D Printers Save Injured Wildlife. Talk about prosthetics for injured animals using 3D printing.
Yeah, so that's really, it's really interesting because 3D printing is really changing the calculus for designing and fitting prosthetics. So just to take and what involves a prosthetic for, say, an elephant is, you know, it requires molding, or for a person, you know, molding the limb, also molding the opposite limb if there's a good limb there so that you can design the new limb in the best way possible for who that animal or person is so that they can match up. And then fitting it. And inevitably, you know, you make it, and just like you trying on shoes, like some fit better than others, or it requires a little adjustment, or, you know, maybe you push the heel in to make it a little softer or whatever.
Right.
And so it's the same way. So with 3D printing, it's easier to do some of that, you know, to take a mold and then put it in a program so that you can tweak it easier and make changes much easier. Of course, it also has its limits in terms of what material you can print and the size of materials. And it also still requires a lot of effort and a team of really dedicated people. So it sounds like a magic bullet, but it's not, you know, it's not a magic bullet. It does let you do a lot more back and forth and fitting and adjusting so that what happens is you end up with a much better fit and you can really make those calculations much more precise. So it particularly works really well for birds.
Oh, interesting.
And lighter kinds of animals. Dogs, they, you know, for dogs, smaller dogs especially, turtles, they've used it for.
Wow. Well, Laurel, are animal prostheses expensive to make, and does 3D printing save time and money in the process?
That's a really good point. It's a lot less expensive to do. A lot of that is because the time can get cut down, way down, because you're able to design things easier. The materials are easier. You can also, outsourcing isn't the right way, but, you know, you can, others can help you and do parts of it remotely a little bit.
Oh, gotcha.
You know, there have been cases of school kids designing certain things. So it's not costless, but it's a lot cheaper, and especially because if you think about building a prosthetic and each one is like a full-fledged prosthetic and then finding out it doesn't fit and then having to adjust it versus, oh, just reprint. You know, let me just adjust and reprint. Like, that's a lot easier. And so the old prosthetics could cost, some of the estimates in terms of time and materials, you know, $100,000 for a flipper for a dolphin, for a tail clipper. And so now I don't have the cost of, say, an eagle's beak, but it's nowhere near that.
Gotcha.
And what that also means is it also means that more people are willing to volunteer because it's not such a costly venture and it's not as a time-consuming venture. So so more people are willing to help, I think.
All right, Laura, we're going to talk about some other interesting animals that you've written about. Tell us about the secretary bird called Suchin or Little Sock at a bird park in Germany.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting story because he had the bird, the keepers came in one morning and the bird had broken her leg inside the enclosure. And secretary birds in particular need their legs. So they're mostly terrestrial birds and they have they're sort of big and they have these really strong, sturdy legs that they not only run with, but they hunt by stomping the ground to flush out animals and then sort of, running them down and then striking them, either with their beak or their feet to catch them. So without a leg, you know, they can't do any of that. And it's a really sweet bird. And so the keepers contacted an organization called Enable, which is it's a very cool online global community of volunteers who use their skills with 3D printers to make free and low-cost prosthetics for people in need. And then sometimes animals. So they got in touch because there was someone, a volunteer who was in Germany, Lars Thalmann, and he helped the keepers design a new leg and fit it to the bird. And that's a prime example of, you know, having a few different versions of this because the first version was sort of modeled exactly on the leg, but it was too heavy for the bird. And so it, you know, imagine if you have one shoe heavier than another, like the balance would be off. And that was exactly the same with that bird. And so he ended up redesigning what he calls a sports version. and so that didn't actually have, the sport version didn't have the foot. So as a way to, but it had all the elements of the foot. So of the leg and foot so that he's able to use it, and he just runs around, or she, that is, just runs around happily wearing the leg all the time.
Oh, nice. Now, back in 2008, a bald eagle named Beauty became the first known bird to receive a 3D-printed beak. What was the nature of her injury?
She had been shot through the beak, and you know, an eagle use their beak. It doesn't just look good, but they use it for so many different things, and for eating, and for tearing apart prey, and without it, and also it's obviously helps them breathe because a bullet had entered through the base of the nasal cavity, and so the bird's sinuses were exposed, and this eagle was going to be euthanized. It was found in Anchorage, and a raptor biologist in Idaho got permission to move Beauty, the eagle, to her care facility in Idaho, and there, she originally had been a nurse, so she thought, why not try a prosthetic on a bald eagle? Because she had been involved with prosthetics with people. And so they designed a beak for her, and it worked really well. The only problem with that effort is that bird's beaks, just like your fingernails, will constantly grow.
Oh.
And even though for Beauty, the beak would never regrow totally, part of it grew just...
You still there, Laurel?
Off.
Nope.
And
All right. Yeah. We lost you for a sec, but you're fine.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
Okay. So it grew just enough that it sort of made the fit wrong. And they thought about doing another one. In Beauty's case, it still involved a lot of stress on the animal to attach it and reattach it and to take measurements. And so in that case, right now, she's not using a 3D beak.
Gotcha.
Because she outgrew it, and she seemed to have adapted to her injury well enough.
All right. Let's see if we can get a call in here. Stephen's calling from Montpelier. Stephen, we're almost out of time, so if you can be as direct as you possibly can.
Just wondered if the author has any experience with the Raptor Center in Queechy.
All right. Laurel?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't with the Raptor Center in Queechy, but for a lot of years, there is a Raptor Rehabilitation Center here in Shelburne, Vermont, the Outreach for Earth Stewardship, which is excellent. And so actually I've volunteered there for years, and so has my son, actually.
Wow.
And so we have been helping out, and it's a great center. It's so difficult to do, so it's a real skill. I don't necessarily have a skill, but I try and help where I can. So I don't handle the raptors themselves, but it's a licensed facility.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So help.
I don't know about it, but you know I'm going to be on it to try to get an interview in the near future. Now, Laurel, I want to know what you're working on next, but you might be already working on it now. But what's next that we'll find from Laurel Neamy?
Well, I've actually been working on a series with National Geographic for the news side related to oil exploration in the Okavango region of Namibia and Botswana. And there's a project there to explore for oil. And there's a number of issues related to it in the way it's being done and the potential impact without fully exploring those impacts and also without involving local communities. So we've been doing a number of pieces related to that. Plus some more kids' books are in the works as well. So always something.
Oh, I love it. And we're almost out of time, but you have probably seen more animals, and especially up close and personally, than the rest of us. Do you have a favorite?
That's a great question. Obviously, I adore elephants. but aside from that obvious answer, I love moose because they're silly looking, and I also love giraffes because they're sort of quiet like me, but also dung beetles, which you can even find here in Vermont. I mean, I just adore dung beetles.
That's the shocker. That's one I wouldn't have expected on anyone's list, and I love that was part of your answer. That is so great. Keep doing what you're doing. Laurel Neamy is a journalist who writes about wildlife crime, forensics, and animal intelligence. She's also the author of 4 books for readers of all ages, including her most recent children's book, The Elephant's New Shoe. Laurel, it's always wonderful hearing about what you've uncovered. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
All right. We're going to break now for CBS News, and then we'll be back to hear about Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice's efforts to vaccinate some of the state's homeless individuals. And a reminder that today at 1 o'clock on WDEV, we'll have the newest installment of Travels with Charlie, followed by The Getaway with Greg Hooker from 2 o'clock to 4. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Over the past 6 months, little by little, I, and I hope you, have had the opportunity to learn more and more about the outstanding work that's being done by Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice. At the very least, I've learned to rattle off the full name of CVHHH without hesitation and to know exactly how many H's there are. Once again, I was amazed, pleased, proud to learn about another initiative of theirs. Joining me now to discuss it is Katie Leffel. She's the maternal child health nurse supervisor at CVHHH. Katie, thank you for being with us this morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And Emily McKenna, who is CVHH's chief marketing and communications officer. Emily, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thank you.
Hi. And listeners, you can call us with your questions or comments at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Emily, what role has CVHHH played in helping to get Vermonters vaccinated with the COVID vaccine?
Well, I think one of the first things that we did was we recognized and realized the importance of trying to figure out an efficient way to get to people who were homebound, our clients included, but also people in the community who aren't currently enrolled on services with CVHHH. How to get them the vaccine efficiently when they became eligible. And one of the ways that we did this was to partner with some local ambulance services, Barry City Ambulance and Waterbury Ambulance. We set up a system. Our CEO, Sandy Roos, worked very closely with them to figure out how to handle and how to administer vaccines to everyone who was eligible and who was homebound. So that means they couldn't they couldn't safely get out of their house, get in the car, and get to one of the public clinics, which were abundant. But, you know, for some people, it just wasn't safe. It wasn't medically indicated for them to get out of the house. And, you know, if you remember, it feels like ages ago, but the weather was, I think, also a factor for a lot of folks who just couldn't, get over a snowbank or safely drive in the snow. So we partnered with our local ambulance services. That was one thing we did. And then we also got a team together of vaccine nurses. There were 12 CVHHH vaccine nurses, including two nurses who had retired but came back to three actually came back and joined the team and joined the effort to help and to vaccinate community members. And to date, we've given over 700 first and second COVID vaccines to Central Vermonters at home. So we're really, really proud of the effort and of the partnership with our nurses and with the local EMT.
Now, I think you've also worked with Norwich University to help in this effort.
Yep. Yeah, we have we had a board member, Paulette Thibault, who is their director of, who I believe is the director of their school of nursing. And we had another new board member come on from Norwich, from their school of nursing as well. And, you know, Sandy, our CEO, is she's always thinking, how can we build relationships in the community? And she thought, well, you know, a lot of times we'll have students from Norwich come through as part of their clinical rotation, but this was such a unique opportunity. I mean, how many times, knock on wood, in our life are we going to be dealing with a global pandemic? So we brought in 18 junior level nursing students and partnered them with one of our vaccine nurses, and they got hands-on experience administering the vaccine and talking to clients about, side effects and about the vaccine, answering questions. And it was, again, another really great partnership, and it benefited us, it benefited the community, and it also benefited the students. It gave them experience that they don't necessarily always get, in school.
And Emily, why is this effort to get people vaccinated, you said over 700 now, by CVHHH, why is that something CVHHH really is involved with and interested in undertaking?
You know, we believe, Sandy Roos, our CEO, believes strongly and talks about this often in letters that she writes to the community. You know, our roots are in Central Vermont. We are so deeply connected to this community and care. So, you know, care, it's our mission, but it's also kind of who we are, and the people who come and work at CVHHH are called to do this work and work for CVHHH because they live here, they care about their neighbors, and, you know, they want their community to be healthy and well. And so it just feels like it's kind of another thing that's a part of who we are and what we felt responsible to do. I think on top of that, we were also just very uniquely equipped to pretty easily and pretty quickly get on the road. You know, we're already going to people's homes, so why not take advantage of that and bring the vaccine to people? It just made a lot of sense, too.
Katie Leffel, what do your nurses tell people about the vaccine, and especially if someone is hesitant to get the shot?
Yeah, well, the first and foremost message we want to get across to people that are hesitant or have questions is to reach out and ask the questions and ask from a reliable source. So, you know, whether that's your home health nurse, whether that's your physician, whether that's Department of Health, just reach out and really have a conversation with someone that knows the facts. Because what we're hearing, of course, as I'm sure everyone is a lot of misinformation coming from social media and or friends and family, with just kind of some of it's really, really wrong, some of it's just a little off.
Katie, everybody I know knows everything about all the vaccines. They know everything.
Right. Well, kind of. Yeah, exactly. And then when kind you of, yeah. The real, you're like, oh, that's not totally right.
Right.
So the biggest fears I've heard among some of the younger moms and families that we work with are questions about, is it safe when I'm pregnant and breastfeeding? Which the answers are yes, and you can actually transfer some of that immunity to your baby, so it's actually a great time to get immunized. And they have all the latest results from the immunization progress has shown that it is safe for pregnant and breastfeeding moms and for their babies. And then, so that's a big question among our population. And then the other questions, can I give people COVID when I have the symptoms after a COVID vaccine? So, you know, am I transmitting the COVID virus when I have those flu-like symptoms after a vaccine? The answer is, of course, no. That is not COVID. It's just your body's natural immunity responding to the vaccine. There's also been quite a few questions about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and whether they're going to get a blood clot from that. And, you know, again, the answer is, unfortunately, there were a few very, very rare cases of an unusual blood clot in women. But that's why they put it on hold. And that's why they did the study or, you know, did a little more research around how the safeness of it. And then now, of course, we found that it's a very small, in fact, a very small, unfortunate number of people. So it's safe, basically, and it is a desirable one because it's a single dose, so it's a lot easier to administer. That's been a big question. There are questions about DNA, too. Does it change my DNA? What does that look like? And again, the answer is no. It does not change your DNA. It uses the messenger RNA, which I don't want to get too technical about it, but it uses some components of our genetic material, the virus's genetic material, to let our body recognize and fight the virus, but it is not something that is left in our genetic code. So that has been a concern. There's lots of sort of confusion about, you know, DNA and genetics and how that works. So just to sort of know, it does not change your DNA.
Okay,
but I want people to hear.
All right.
What other questions? Those are the big main ones. There's some questions about how long it lasts, which of course nobody really knows yet.
Right.
Things like that. The big concerns are really about getting sick afterwards. That's the most often concern I have, which, you know, my usual response is, you know, 2 or 3 days, maybe 4 days of feeling under the weather is a whole lot better than getting COVID and transmitting it to other people. So, yes, you may have a few days where you feel under the weather, but that's a whole lot better than COVID and those, you know, potential illnesses related to long the lingering effects of COVID and things like that as well.
Right.
And just to really remind people, there is a lot of our population that is unable to get the vaccine right now, including children under the age of 15 currently, 15 and under. Hopefully that will change as time goes by, but the best way to protect all the children in our community is by getting this vaccine.
Wow, that's a great point, Katie. Katie, yes. What training is conducted for not just your nurses, but the people who are collaborating with CVHHH to make sure vaccines are handled and administered properly?
Are you asking how we train our nurses?
Or, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so basically our vaccination team are the main ones that are handling the vaccinations, and they are a sort of crack team of, you know, trained on how to make sure that the vaccines are used effectively and kept safely stored. So the issue is not just are they safely stored, but how do we use up every dose of that vial once we crack the vial. So that team has really worked hard to make sure that every dose that we draw up is used, so including like a wait list of, you know, in the community and things like that too, to really make sure that we aren't wasting any. So most of the effort around training and keeping those vaccines in at the right temperatures and all the details that go into that is actually handled by a specific team.
Nice.
And we just go to them for support, or if we need some doses or if we have somebody to add to the wait list, we go to them. So,
all right.
And I can yeah. add quickly, I believe that a lot of the individuals on the vaccine team have in the past participated in our public flu clinic, so they're familiar with, you know, they're kind of familiar with the general process and how to prep someone and what to say. So I think that was part of it too. They kind of came in with some knowledge.
Yeah. Sometimes we forget that, you know, we've been doing this vaccination, you know, with the flu vaccine every year. So there are a lot of things we did learn through the years from that. So that's pretty great point, Emily. Emily, what telemedicine, telehealth efforts has CVHHH been involved with during the pandemic to educate and to help keep people connected?
Yeah, one thing we're particularly proud of is that we didn't have to stand up a whole new program. We've had a telemedicine program for a number of years, and the pandemic, it gave us an opportunity to kind of think outside the box in a lot of ways. Programs or pilots or partnerships, again, that we were starting to work on, we just got a little bit further down the road with those. Most importantly, when we were in the height of the pandemic, we reviewed every patient's and oncoming patient's medical record to figure out, okay, so what is the best way to serve this person while also keeping in mind their safety, the safety of our staff, and reducing any possibility of transmission. So we kind of incorporated telemedicine into people's plans of care whenever it made medical sense. And we also use, you know, telemedicine isn't just a video visit on an iPad. It's a phone call to someone. One of the things that we did, again, during the height of the pandemic is one of our PCAs made regular check-in calls to our long-term care clients and people who were home who normally get visits from a personal care attendant. And, you know, when I spoke with her, her name is Crystal, and she said, you know, some people wanted to talk for 2 minutes. Some people wanted to talk for 40 minutes. It was a really important way for us to maintain connections with our clients and to make sure that they had food. And if they didn't, we would, you know, kind of connect them with someone who could help them, just to keep in touch and to make sure people's emotional needs were being met, you know, as well as their physical needs. And, you know, we have kind of a number of ways that we're piloting using the telemonitor now. Going forward with hospice clients and with some patients at the CVMC cardiology practice. And I think kind of the pandemic kind of pushed us to take steps. And it's been great because we're finding lots of new opportunities to use the telemedicine to complement the in-person care that we can provide people.
Katie, what's the work that CVHHH has been doing for people in transitional housing?
Yeah, so actually it's been a really wonderful partnership. We have worked with the Good Samaritan and People's Health and Wellness and the Department of Health to support the families and people that are living in the general assistance housing and hotels and the transitional housing, and then the people actually unhoused on the streets around surveillance testing for COVID originally. So And then also now we've pivoted to the COVID vaccination clinics. And Teresa Fennell from the Good Sam has been instrumental in organizing those. She's been really amazing on that. And we have all come together to staff them as well. So we've had two clinics already for people that live in the hotels, like I said, and then also other homeless or unhoused people. And then we are actually having an upcoming pop-up clinic on the 18th at People's Health and Wellness Clinic in the Blanchard Block in Barrie, May 18th from 11 to 3 at the J&J Johnson & Johnson walk-in clinic. So that's another clinic we're having, and then again, we're going to have the second clinic for the Moderna vaccine that we did the first step. We did two clinics already. So that's a really exciting community project that we've worked on together to really pull together and serve this population that was a high-risk population. And then also just doing some real work around, again, the hesitancy and the fear factor and talking to people and helping them get transportation to the clinics and those kind of things. And then also I've worked with community partners. You know, on Friday I picked up two doses of the vaccine from another walk-in clinic that Capstone was having for their early Head Start clients. I was able to secure two doses of vaccine and actually drive it to one of my clients and vaccinate a pregnant mom and her boyfriend that were had some fears and some hesitancy around it. So I was able to just, you know, work with our community partners, just sort of a last-minute thing, and call, you know, the Capstone partners and say, hey, do you have two extra doses? And they did end up having extra doses at the end of the clinic. I was able to grab them and just show up at my client's house and say, wow. You know, strike while the iron's hot, and they were willing to accept it then, so I was able to do it. So we're really working closely with our community partners to make sure that these harder-to-reach populations are getting the information they need and then, again, getting access to the vaccines. There's major transportation issues and a lot of different things that are barriers for Central Vermonters getting that vaccine who may be open to it if you can get it to them.
Yeah, and
so that's
Katie,
what we're really working on.
Why are these specific efforts that you just mentioned so vital in the overall strategy of getting people vaccinated?
Well, it's just it's a piece of the big puzzle. So I think everybody who's eligible, who was motivated and had transportation and connectivity to the internet and all those pieces have gotten their vaccine for the most part. And so now there's these other kind of populations that have barriers to getting the vaccine or are more hesitant or are busy, you know, working, people that are working full-time or having a hard, you know, there's lots of different populations now, pockets of these populations that we really need to be able to target and do a little bit more of a targeted approach and, like, what's going to work to get these people vaccinated. Because the more, of course, we all know, the more we can vaccinate, the better off we'll do in the future at protecting, like, the people that can't get vaccinated and from some of these variants. So we're really working hard in Vermont, and we're doing a great job at reaching hard-to-reach populations or hesitant populations. And it's going to take a lot of innovative solutions.
Yeah.
There isn't, one approach that's going to work.
Emily, I would never have wanted anything like this to happen in our lifetime, but during this pandemic, there have been certain positives, and one is it's called Everyone Eats Vermont. Explain what that program mm-hmm. is all about.
I actually think Katie has been absolutely instrumental in getting Everyone Eats to Central Vermont. So I think Katie should answer because she's been put so much work into getting it off the ground. So Katie,
I didn't mean to slight you there.
Oh. Yeah, no, that's I want she knows more about it. Yeah.
Okay,
so
good.
It's a Capstone project. They've worked really hard to integrate it into several different counties now. I believe it started in Washington County, though, and so our home health agency was one of the early adopters of the program. And basically the idea is that we are bringing frozen prepared meals to families or to people that have lack access to food or are for some reason related to COVID or health risks, unable to get to the grocery store as often as they might like to get there. So that's one piece of it. The other half of it is that the meals are actually prepared by local restaurants. So in order to keep the local restaurants up and running, Capstan was able to secure grants to pay the restaurants per meal. And then we get them delivered every week. We have a giant freezer in the maternal child house, which is also supplied by the Everybody Eats program. And so we actually bring meals to our clients. And the whole agency hasn't participated in this. We've been moving thousands and thousands of meals, and I want to say that the Everybody Eats program in general has delivered over a million meals since the beginning of the pandemic to Lamoille, Washington, Orange County. So it's been an incredible program. It's really helped the restaurants, and it's really helped families to be able to bring a really great home-cooked meal, you know, that's frozen, because they're really delicious meals. Mm-hmm. To be able to bring that to like a new family with a new baby who doesn't, you know, want to bring a newborn baby to the grocery store, you know, so we're able to bring a meal at least a week to them. And, you know, and all the other, our hospice program and our home care program are able to bring these meals. It's been pretty incredible.
Yeah. Kudos to everyone involved with that. Emily, we have about a minute left. CVHHH has had, it's been under strain, especially in those early confusing days of the pandemic, and as the case numbers grew from October onward. So how have you been able to deal with it and remain operating?
I think, you know, it's funny that you asked that question. We're kind of right in the middle of Nurses Week.
Yes,
I want to recognize the nurses and all of our clinicians. I think, given how we do our work, going to people and bringing care to people at home, I think we were in a unique position to be able to adapt and to mobilize. And as soon as COVID hit, we created this internal task force and kind of set up top priorities in terms of getting PPE and reviewing patient records and figuring out how to incorporate telemedicine. And our staff, because of how they deliver care and are used to thinking on their feet, rolling up their shirt sleeves, that's what they did. They were just ready to kind of pivot and to kind of change how they delivered care. And it wasn't that much of a disruption to their work lives. And I think, you know, again, kind of calling on those relationships in the community with our partners, recognizing there are some things that we do or that we're really good at. There are some things that you're really good at. Let's figure out how we can come together and kind of bring a new idea to meet a new need into the community and to serve people. So it was just doing what we do best and kind of always being open, I think, to collaborating and to working with our community partners.
Emily McKenna is the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer at CVHHH. Katie Leffel is the Maternal Child Health Nurse Supervisor. Thank you both for the work you're doing and for being on with me this morning. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And happy Nurses Week. Okay, we're going to hop out for a CBS News break. When we get back, it's open phones time, and I want to hear about your moms. So share a story. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All right, we've got the opportunity to chat now. I've got open phones until 11. I'd love to hear about the women we honored yesterday, those wonderful moms in our lives. If they're anything like my mom was, they were selfless and loving and worried every minute of every day about you. Listeners, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I'll tell you about my own dear mom in a little bit, who sadly we lost earlier this year, but her influence and love are present every single day, and I still think about picking up the phone, chatting with her. We can also talk about whatever else is on your mind. I'm going to have to admit that Last week, Danny knows this, I accepted a birthday gift under false pretenses. Uh-oh. So I'll come clean about that in a few minutes. My apologies. What else do we have? Driving pet peeves, celebrity near misses. We're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Hop on in. Join me on the open phones. Let me know what you're thinking, or let me know about your mom, your grandparents, your grandmothers. I'd love to hear about them. You know, it's going to sound like all I ever talk about with my relatives are food when I talk about my mom and my grandmothers. But I'll tell the stories of these wonderful women in my life. So with my mom, you know, and it's such a great way to bond was cooking, especially the summer before I went away to college. I spent hours whenever I'd be home watching mom cook and asking a ton of questions. And she wasn't bothered. You know, you'd think maybe having this 17-year-old boy lurking in your kitchen for hours on end would unnerve you, but she never bothered. And it's interesting because so much of what she taught me during that summer, you know, I still use in my cooking. For years on end, when we talk on the phone, oh, this is tough. All right. Anyway, she'd ask what I was cooking, and if it was anything she'd eat. There were seemed like with my mom, there were two kind of food groups. There was, kind of, traditional, you know, foods like a pot roast or a, you know, a broiled chicken. And then there was anything nouveau that I might make or, you know, ethnic, like a momo or, you know, something that she had never, actually eaten. And so I knew right away when she'd ask, which food group what I was cooking fell into. And there were some nights when I would say no, and she was far less interested in hearing what it was I was cooking. So help me out here. Love to hear from you about you know, memories of your mom or your wives who have been great to, as mothers of your children. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And then my grandmothers, one Slovak, one German, and, you know, two different styles of culinary worlds there. But, you know, you learn to eat both, right? And you learn to enjoy. At first, it's all food to you as a kid. You have no idea, like, why does this grandmother cook with more cabbage, you know, and why does this one do more of this? And then, you know, you start to learn, you know, the backgrounds they come from. Interesting, neither, no Italian, even though my name sounds Italian, no Italian in my background, although I absolutely love Italian food. And if that was all I had to eat all day long, I'd be happy with that as well. All right, 244-1777, 877-291-8255 on this Monday morning. We've got open phones. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And remember, if you don't call, I just keep gabbing and gabbing. And I'm a little verklempt talking about Mother's Day this year. All right. So when was the 6th, Danny? Thursday, right? Thursday on the show. Yeah, it was the first segment of the day. We talked about Writers for Recovery, and Gary Miller, I believe, was the guest's name. And just at the very end of our conversation, Gary kind of blurts out, "Hey, can I say one more thing?" "Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, we had just enough time." And Gary wished a happy birthday to a woman who's in the Writers for Recovery group. And it was very nice. And then we signed off. And a little later, we got a call. Danny took a call from a listener who wished me a happy birthday. And So we thought it was harmless because, see, it really was not my birthday, May 6th. Obviously, the listener misheard what was going on there. And so that was all fine and good. But then within about a half hour, this wonderful listener, Cindy, sent over from Stowe Street Emporium a nice bag with a birthday card and some chocolates and a gift as well. And I wasn't sure what to do, man, because my birthday is actually December 27th, not May 6th. And so, you know, you're kind of like, how do I handle this? This is such a lovely gesture by Cindy. The problem is it wasn't my birthday. Well, you can justify just about anything. And, the chocolates are gone. Danny got to have one as well. And, here's the deal. My birthday is such a crappy one. December 27th. It has been, and Danny's is the 28th of December, but, it has been missed, so often. You rarely get birthday parties as a kid. School's not around, you know, nobody's around at school from school. And so it just kind of gets glossed over. Oh, yeah, you got some gifts in there that are birthday gifts. And so, I'm going to take this gift and my new alt birthday, May 6th, and not feel as guilty as I should, because it was a lovely gesture, by Cindy, and I want to thank you. But Cindy, it wasn't really my birthday. If you want the chocolates and stuff back, you can always, you know, let me know. All right. We're at 244-1777, 877-291-8244, for open phones up till 11 o'clock. And we are going to start with Rich in Starksboro. Hey, Rich, how you doing?
Oh, pretty good, Rick. You?
Great to hear from you. Yeah, very well. Thanks.
I have a solution that may or may not work. Probably won't, but at least I'll propose a solution for your birthday thing.
Okay.
My really great friend Tom, who I've known since I was 10 years old, his birthday is May 6th, and I call him up, and my wife and I, we sing happy birthday over to him on the phone.
So, right.
If you want to just transfer those flowers and whatever over to him, you can do that. But that'd be complicated, I guess. But anyway, it's just an idea.
All right. Yeah, I could send Tom some belated gifts.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah, don't let your May 6th presents go to waste. Send them over to Tom.
There you go. Yeah.
But, oh, that's funny.
I appreciate you talking about your mom. It means a lot to all of us out there listening. Just want to let you know that. And my mom died 10 years ago, April 27th. And,
oh,
you know, I still have it's not as intense as it was, you know, the first year she died, but, you know, it's pretty, you know, still pretty intense. I can still, when I left her after the funeral, when I left her house, I knew I was never going to come back to this home and see my mother here again.
Yep.
You know, and it just kind of blew me away. I could hardly breathe, you know. But I wanted to, you had a guest on the other day about wilderness.
True North Wilderness Program.
Yeah, for wilderness therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the guest might have mentioned, I could have this wrong. I usually get stuff wrong.
It's all right.
I think the guest might have mentioned that it was the only facility in Vermont, only entity in Vermont that does this kind of thing. But if that, either way, there's another entry, whether they said it or not.
Mm-hmm.
There's Confluence Behavioral Health in East Thetford.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's at the top of a hill called Gove Hill. Their kind of main building is a building built in 1906 by the attorney for the copper mine thing that's now a federal something or other fundy thingy.
Yeah,
a dirty place.
Super, super fun site.
Super, I don't know if super gets in there, but anyway, but yeah. It's super.
Well, it's because I think it needs a super cleanup.
There you go.
Yep.
And I think they worked on about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yep. Yeah, but and True North, the distinction might be, and I don't know, you know, the two programs well enough to know the distinction, but True North, I know they're pretty much, you know, everything is done outdoors, you know, and so it could be that that's what, you know, their program, how they differentiate, that theirs is unique in that way, so, but not sure. Yeah. And what's the one in East Thetford again, Confluence?
It's just called Confluence, basically, but their legal name is Confluence Behavioral Health LLC.
Gotcha.
And it says there at the top of their website, Wilderness Adventure Therapy, exploring opportunity for positive change through intentional outdoor activity.
Yep. Okay. So very similar in that regard. Well, Rich, thank you so much.
Sure. Maybe they can come talk sometime.
Yep. You got it.
All right.
Always happy to look for, you know, have suggestions on guests. So,
yeah.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
All right. Take care, Rich. I'm a little surprised, Danny. I thought when I asked people to call in and tell us about their moms this day after Mother's Day, I thought we'd be kind of swarmed. But we've only heard from Rich so far from Starksboro. Thank you, Rich. But you can talk about any subject. That's the way the open phones always work. On Thursday, we had at 10:30 at this time, we had a really interesting conversation with Katie Hamilton from up at Bev's in Williston about the dog blood donation program. And I'm still really chuffed about this. I'm excited that no one I've run into yet knew that, you know, there's a deal with where your dogs can give blood and the different types of blood and, that dogs can get transfusions and all that. And it was a wonderful conversation. If you are interested in something like that, go and listen to our podcast. You can find it at WDEVradio.com from Thursday. It's the final segment of the day. And not only is it interesting, but Katie Hamilton gets more excited about talking about that dog blood donation program than just about anyone I've had on in the whatever it's been 6 or 7 months that I've been hosting this show. She really takes great pride in what she's doing, and it's pretty cool. And Bev's it's Burlington Emergency Veterinary something, and it's in Williston. Anyway, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Those are the numbers to call to let us know what you want to talk about. And, boy, I've got a lot of time to fill if we don't get those phones ringing pretty soon. And I don't have a lot to talk about. I do love what's happening with our socks. They are looking outstanding. You know, this is the same team, the Orioles, that they got swept by to start the season. And, boy, what a difference the season has made since that point. Right after those three losses, they went on a 9-game tear and have been sitting in first place in the AL East ever since. Of course, we do see the New York Yankees creeping up on them, but I think the Sox still have like a 3.5-game lead or something, you know, since even with the Yanks starting to play ball. The Yanks started off slowly. But this is a season that we didn't necessarily expect the Sox to be doing well, and they're 9 games over 500 right now, so back-to-back walk-offs. It's really great stuff. So love seeing our Sox. Yeah, 3.5 games up on the Yankees. The Orioles have dropped into last 6.5 games out. All right, so let's go to the phones, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And to Montpelier we go for Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I just have a quick question.
Yeah.
That one of your listeners might know the answer to.
All right.
Years ago, I went to a museum somewhere in Vermont that specialized in barbed wire, all the different kinds of barbed wire, you know, the ones with strands and the ones, all the different ones with steel and all these different kinds. And I just wonder if any of the listener might know where that was.
Now, how long ago would this have been, Stephen?
This would be about 30 years ago, maybe.
Oh, okay. All right. The only reason I ask is I remember the Museum of Everyday Life did, I think one of the years they did barbed wire as their items, you know, that people, you know, would make art out of. But, you're thinking of something completely different, and that would be crazy interesting to know about. I hope there's a listener out there, you know, in whatever town that it was, and you don't have an idea of which way it might have been in here in the state.
I really don't.
All right. I'm seeing some. I'm doing a quick search. And there's one in Kansas and one in Texas, but I'm not finding anything in Vermont. So, listeners, that Stephen, you know, you're the one who threw out the idea of dogs giving blood, and that turned into an interesting segment. So the museum in Vermont that specialized in barbed wire probably about 30 years ago, if anyone knows, help Stephen, help me, 244-1777, 877-291. 8255. You can email it in vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And if nobody, you know, Stephen, if no one calls in, it's my homework. Again, my homework assignments are getting long and I've got to get to work on some of them. All right, Stephen, that's great.
Thanks for that.
A museum in Vermont that specialized in all sorts of barbed wire. And there are, you know, there are different museums, real quirky ones that specialize in like medical instruments. As a matter of fact, I think there might be something in Vermont like that. Is it in the islands? Maybe Grand Isle? But this is different. Specialized in barbed wire. And that would have been about 30 years ago that Stephen happened into that. So anybody knows, let us know. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Have a few more minutes. We can talk about anything. Obviously, I have certain food, sports, or travel. Those are definitely my wheelhouses. Vermontania. What do they call it? Vermontania. You know, is something that I tend to know a little bit about, having traveled hither and yon all over the state in my 18 years here. So sometimes I can figure it out. Could not figure that one out. Barbed wire. Wow, that's wild. You know, I'm going to be lining them up as soon as I find out who that might be. There was down, I want to say Bethel area down that way. You'd drive by this house and out front there'd be a sign and it was like the Hall of Fame, but it was like the history of, what do they call it? The Trotters and the Pacers, the horse racing with the little jockey riding in the back, not on the horse, but harness racing. It was like a harness racing museum or something in the middle of nowhere, Vermont. Anybody remember that? I think it was down Killington Way. I never stopped in. I just wanted to, you know, you don't know what you can do. Can I just drive up, knock on their door? It's Vermont. Of course you could. I should have done it. I wonder if that's still around. All right. Next time I whirl around the state, I have got to stop at the quirkiest places I can find so I can let you know about them. I guess that's going to about do it. I do want to wish all the moms, all the grandmothers, aunts, happy Mother's Day. I hope you had a wonderful time yesterday. That will do it. Thanks for listening. And I don't know that we have open phones the rest of the week, maybe on Friday. So booked all the way through Thursday right now. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan, and our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast, wdevradio.com. What's next? Common Sense Radio, Bill Sayre, that's up next. And then I'm Rick Sangari. I will meet you back here tomorrow.